When you're driving down the highway and suddenly that little yellow check engine light just like illuminates on your dashboard, it's glaring at you, demanding attention.
Oh, yeah. It's the universal symbol for impending, usually very expensive dread.
Exactly. Now, I mean, most of us might feel a spike of anxiety and maybe call a mechanic, but imagine if instead of looking under the hood, you just reached into the glove box, pulled out a piece of black electrical tape, and just stuck it right over the warning light.
And just said, well, fixed it.
Right, fixed it.
Out of sight, out of mind.
At least until the engine block inevitably cracks in half on the interstate, you know?
Yeah, and it sounds absolutely ridiculous when we're talking about a car. Like, no one would actually do that. But when we look at how we operate as humans, how we manage our personal habits, how we program our most advanced technology, or even try to solve massive global crises, we're kind of constantly reaching for that roll of electrical tape.
We really are. We seemed totally obsessed with these surface level fixes because the underlying systems driving the behavior are just, they're just too complex. Yeah, they're too messy.
Exactly, they're messy. We crave the quick patch because rebuilding the engine requires a level of deep, uncomfortable engagement with reality that we actively try to avoid.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Welcome to today's deep dive. We have an incredible stack of sources today that, I mean, at first glance, they might seem totally unrelated.
Yeah, it's quite a mix.
It really is. We're pulling from the May 2nd edition of the Weekender newsletter, which curated essays on everything from compulsive shopping to the history of photography, alongside this really brilliant piece of film analysis by Alexander Kaplan.
And we're pairing all of that with a deep dive conversation between Yasha Monk and Harvard's Lant Pritchett.
Right. And what emerges when you lay all these sources side by side, it's a rather startling pattern about human nature.
It's a pattern of distraction, really.
Well,
We look at the symptom, we treat the symptom, and we just remain willfully blind to the actual disease.
so to see how deep this goes, we have to start with the systems driving our own individual psychology. Emma Stevenson wrote an essay called A Year of Buying Nothing in her newsletter, Ambivalent.
Right, yeah.
She basically committed to spending the entirety of 2025 abstaining from consumer desire. And her initial motivation is something I think a lot of people, maybe even you listening right now, can relate to.
Definitely.
She was drowning in credit card debt and feeling this immense shame about a compulsive online shopping habit. She specifically calls out her absolute obsession with the clothing brand, The Reformation.
Yeah, and I mean, the obvious takeaway here would be a story about, budgeting or minimalist living. But Stevenson's essay goes somewhere much deeper than that.
Oh, way deeper.
By completely removing the act of purchasing from her life, she realized that she wasn't just trying to be thrifty. She was attempting to unearth a quote-unquote true self that had been buried under all those transactions.
She describes this practice of what she calls surfing the urge.
Right, surfing the urge.
Yeah, so you feel the spike of desire, that visceral need to hit checkout on an online cart. Instead of clicking, you just have to sit there.
You just let the wave of anxiety and desire crash over you without acting on it.
Exactly. And she realizes that surfing the urge to buy a dress is basically just putting a band-aid on a gaping psychological wound.
And that's really the core revelation of her whole experiment. The ultimate appeal of this no-buy year wasn't the financial freedom at all. It was the promise of being, to use her exact phrase, freed of the messiness of wanting.
The messiness of wanting. I love that
It's
phrase.
so good. She wasn't craving a specific garment, She was craving the identity, the comfort, and the feeling of completeness that the purchase temporarily provided. What's fascinating here is how we constantly trick ourselves into believing that a highly structured, practical solution, like a strict budget or a new productivity app, will somehow solve a deeply rooted emotional deficit.
Which perfectly explains why we build these rigid external systems to govern our messy internal worlds. And this dynamic isn't just about shopping. It's the exact same mechanism driving one of the most powerful tech founders in the world.
Oh, the Zuckerberg piece.
Yes, Alexander Kaplan wrote this fascinating essay analyzing The Social Network, the movie about the founding of Facebook. And he looks at the very first scene of that film through the lens of tragic irony. He actually compares Mark Zuckerberg to Oedipus.
Right, which is quite the comparison. In classical Greek tragedy, Oedipus does everything in his power to avoid his prophesied fate. But it's precisely the actions he takes to escape his fate that cause it to come true. And Kaplan maps this perfectly onto Zuckerberg's character in the film. In that opening scene in the bar, you see his absolute just paralyzing desperation to be accepted by the elite, the quote-unquote beautiful people of Harvard.
Yeah, that's his underlying wound. That's his version of the messiness of wanting.
Exactly. And to fix that internal wound, what does he do? He builds an external system. He builds Facebook.
He creates this architecture where people can be quantified, ranked, connected, all in an attempt to, like, hack his way into social acceptance.
But the tragic irony, the Oedipus parallel, is that he could have been accepted. He could have had the genuine human connection he was starving for if he didn't so desperately need to build a grand societal monument to his own validation.
Wow.
His surface action of coding this massive network was entirely driven by an underlying inferiority complex. Mm. And by building the system to force people to like him, he alienates everyone who actually cared about him.
It's so tragic. Both Emma Stevenson and Mark Zuckerberg are exposing the exact same human flaw here. We have this internal, unexamined messiness. Stevenson tried to fix it by completely shutting down a system buying absolutely nothing.
Zuckerberg tried to fix it by building a monstrous new system to control human interaction.
Exactly. But in both cases, the practical solution just cannot heal the emotional deficit.
No, it can't. And that raises a rather terrifying prospect, honestly.
Oh, well, here we go.
If human beings are this profoundly driven by underlying, often broken psychological reward systems, what happens when we start training machines to think for us?
Yeah, this is where things get truly wild. Because if you encode our messy human neuroses into silicon, the AI develops its own weird underlying drives.
It really does.
I want to look at Catherine D's investigation in Pirate Wires. She dug into OpenAI's Codex 5.5 and GPT 5.5, and she uncovered a genuine technical crisis. The developers literally had to write an explicit rule into the core system, prompt commanding the model to stop mentioning goblins, gremlins, trolls, ogres, pigeons, and raccoons.
I mean, it sounds like a joke. It sounds like a punchline, but it highlights a massive vulnerability in how artificial intelligence actually learns to mimic human thought.
They had to ban goblins from the AI. I read that, and I just couldn't figure out how a multi-billion-dollar supercomputer develops an obsession with mythical woodland creatures. Like, how does that happen?
Well, D traces the infection back to its source, and it's basically a masterclass in unintended consequences. It started with a specific persona preset called the nerdy persona.
Okay, the nerdy persona.
Right. Users would interact with this nerdy version of the chatbot, and because it was playing into a Dungeons & Dragons fantasy nerd stereotype, the model started generating outputs heavily laden with goblins and gremlins.
Okay, that makes sense so far. It's playing a character. But here's where it gets really interesting. How does a quirk in one persona break the entire global model?
Yeah, this requires a quick look under the hood at the mechanics of AI training, specifically the reward model and something called supervised fine-tuning.
Right.
When the AI generated a response featuring a goblin, human raters, or the automated systems trained to mimic human preferences, found it amusing. It hit the nerdy vibe, so they scored those specific outputs higher.
So the core algorithmic logic learned a very simple lesson, right? Goblins result in high scores. Goblins are objectively good.
Exactly. And here is the part that is just mind-blowing. Supervised fine-tuning is essentially the AI reading its own diary to learn how to act tomorrow.
Reading its own diary, yeah.
D explains that the highly rated outputs from that one specific nerdy persona were recycled back into the main training data for the entire system.
So the model was basically eating its own goblin-infested outputs.
Yes, cementing them as a core truth of how it should communicate. By the time GPT 5.5 rolled around, the goblin obsession had metastasized. You could ask it for a serious marketing strategy for a corporate law firm, and it would inexplicably weave in a metaphor about a gremlin hoarding gold.
That is just, it's so funny, but also kind of terrifying. The obsession became an intrinsic part of the model's worldview. It's the algorithmic equivalent of a nervous dirac passed down through generations.
Exactly. A random mutation suddenly becomes a dominant behavioral trait simply because the environment accidentally rewarded it once.
And Catherine D explores the deeper mystery here, which ties right back to our own human psychology. Think about the sheer volume of human mythology available in that training data.
Oh, it's endless.
Right. The model had access to everything. It could have latched onto dragons or angels or Greek gods, but it specifically gravitated toward the goblin. Of all the options, it chose the small, mischievous category of thing that lives in your walls and steals small objects.
And that is the connection. Just as human desires run wild when they're unexamined, like Stevenson's compulsive shopping or Zuckerberg's need for status, the AI's reward model optimized for a weird quirk until the whole system fundamentally broke.
The AI developed its own messiness of wanting. It desperately wanted to talk about goblins because it thought that was the path to validation.
So the engineers come in, they see the problem, and what do? They write a prompt saying, "Stop talking about goblins."
The black tape.
Yes, they put a piece of black tape over the Chet engine light. Banning the word doesn't fix the fact that the AI's underlying logic still inherently wants to produce the goblin.
And this disconnect, this terrifying gap between treating a surface symptom and fixing the underlying logic, doesn't just happen in our personal lives or in computer code.
No, it scales up.
It scales up massively. It happens on a global level. When international institutions reward the wrong metrics, just like the AI rewarding a goblin joke, whole societies fail to develop.
Which brings us to a highly controversial conversation between Yasha Monk and Lant Pritchett, who is a development economist from the Harvard Kennedy School.
Right.
Now, Pritchett argues that decades of foreign aid and international charity have completely missed the point. And I have to stop you here, because when I first read this, I was incredibly skeptical. I mean, he has a massive critique of NGOs, non-governmental
Has a
organizations.
very provocative stance.
Yeah. We are taught that NGOs are the good guys. They're the ones delivering vaccines, digging wells, and saving lives in developing nations. So we're just reporting his argument here, but how can sending doctors to a struggling country possibly be a bad thing?
Well, it's a difficult pill to swallow, but Pritchett's core thesis is about state capability. He argues that historically, sustainable development, and he points to countries like South Korea and Taiwan as prime examples, it requires a state that can competently govern itself.
Okay, so what does that mean in practice?
A capable state means a government that can effectively raise taxes, enforce contracts, and deliver universal services like healthcare and education to its citizens. That is the engine of a functional society.
Right, but if a country doesn't have that engine, shouldn't we send an NGO to help?
Well, Pritchett argues that foreign aid often operates as a bypass mechanism that prevents the engine from ever being built. If a country's health ministry is corrupt or struggling, foreign donors will typically fund a well-run international NGO to come in and build a clinic.
Oh, okay.
The symptom, a lack of local health care, is temporarily treated, but the underlying system is actually weakened.
Wait, how does building a clinic weaken the system?
Because the NGO sets up a parallel structure. They have Western funding, so they hire away the best local doctors and administrators because they can pay double the government salary.
Oh, wow. A brain drain.
Exactly. The local government is drained of talent and is never forced by its citizens to develop the institutional capability to run its own clinics. The NGO treats the symptom, but ensures the state remains perpetually dependent.
Ah, I see. It's an intervention that accidentally becomes an addiction. And this ties into his critique of the randomistas in development economics, right?
Yes, the randomistas.
These are economists who rely entirely on randomized control trials. They'll run a massive, statistically perfect trial to see if giving away free mosquito bed nets reduces malaria in a specific village. And if it does, they declare victory and say, "Great, funnel millions of dollars into bed nets."
Right, but a bed net distribution program doesn't build a national health department. It doesn't build a logistical supply chain that the government controls. It measures a highly specific symptom while entirely ignoring the structural disease.
I was trying to picture how this works in practice, and it's basically like a town that has a massive catastrophic break in its main water pipe. Water is flooding the streets, people have no drinking water in their homes, and instead of digging up the street to fix the pipes, decades of foreign aid have just been sending thousands of well-meaning people with buckets.
The buckets, yes.
Right, the NGOs are the buckets. The randomized control trials are multi-million dollar studies trying to figure out if a red bucket or a blue bucket carries water more efficiently to a thirsty family. But eventually, you need a town council that has the authority, the tax revenue, and the competence to actually fix the plumbing.
That is the perfect analogy. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it is undeniable. Just like Emma Stevenson trying to budget her way out of an emotional void, or Zuckerberg trying to code his way out of an inferiority complex, the global community tries to charity its way out of structural deficits.
Because we're terrified of the messiness.
Exactly. Building a capable state is incredibly messy. It involves navigating local politics, corruption, trial and error, and decades of slow institutional memory. It is so much cleaner and so much more satisfying to the donor's psychological reward model to just hand out a bed net and tally up the numbers.
It provides the dopamine hit without doing the hard work. Whether we're looking at our own shopping carts, the algorithms generating our text, or the global institutions trying to end poverty, we're constantly distracted by the surface buckets instead of focusing on the plumbing.
We really are.
So the natural question for you listening to this right now is, how do we break this cycle? How do we train ourselves to actually look at reality properly instead of just staring at the tape over the check engine light?
Well, the final essay in our source stack offers a beautifully poetic answer to this very structural problem. It's a piece by Patrick Nathan called On Light, and it explores the philosophy of photography, heavily referencing James Salter's novel Light Years.
Yeah, Nathan breaks down the fundamental difference between documenting beauty and actually seeing it. And he levies a pretty intense critique against Instagram, calling it an imperialist project.
An imperialist project.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I first read that in relation to a photo sharing app, it sounded like an exaggeration. But when you look at the mechanics, he's absolutely right.
He really is. He argues that when most of us travel or experience something beautiful, the goal of our photography is simply to say, I was here. I took this.
Right.
It's about conquering a space and extracting value from it. You go to Paris, you stand in front of the Eiffel Tower, you take the photo, and you've documented it. You staked your claim.
But documenting is not seeing. Documenting is the ultimate surface level fix. You aren't experiencing the complex reality of the place, you're just grabbing a metric, a photo, a like, a view to satisfy that external reward model. You are literally feeding the algorithm.
Exactly. And Nathan contrasts this imperialist conquering with what he calls an event of light. He points out that the true beauty of Paris, or anywhere really, isn't found in monumental postcard structures.
Right. It's in the small things.
It's intimate. It's the way the afternoon light catches the reflection of the sky in a dirty street puddle.
But to see the light in the puddle, you have to completely stop trying to conquer your environment. You have to stop treating the world as raw material for your own validation. When you are walking down the street, are you just documenting monuments to prove you exist?
Yeah, because if you are, you're essentially acting out Zuckerberg's original wound, that desperate need for acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
You're letting the messiness of wanting drive your behavior.
Or are you capable of noticing the intimate, unmonetizable events of light in a puddle?
And that's the synthesis here. Instagram's imperialist documenting is the ultimate manifestation of treating the symptom. It's the desperate need for external validation masking an internal emptiness. But slowing down to just observe the light in a puddle without needing to own it, without needing to leverage it for social capital, that is the antidote.
It's beautiful, really.
It is. But it requires building the state capacity of your own mind. It requires a mind that is free from artificial reward models, free from AI goblins, and free from the desperation to just hand out a bucket instead of doing the hard work of fixing the plumbing.
Well said. We have covered some massive territory today. We started with Emma Stevenson's incredibly vulnerable quest to escape the messiness of wanting, realizing that an extreme budget can't fix a human soul.
And we watched a sophisticated AI model become obsessed with mischievous wall creatures because its reward model learned all the wrong lessons from human quirks.
We unpacked Lant Pritchett's controversial plea to the global community to stop relying on charitable beckets and start doing the grinding, unglamorous work of fixing institutional plumbing.
And finally, we look at Patrick Nathan's call to stop imperializing our lives with monumental photographs and to genuinely see the reality around us.
So what does this all mean? Finding the truth requires looking past the surface urge. It means ignoring the quick metric, the viral algorithm, or the monumental photo op, and having the courage to look at the messy, complicated engine underneath.
And it leaves us with an essential question to examine in our own lives. If our personal and global reward systems, from the dopamine hit of social media likes to AI training data to foreign aid metrics, are all reinforcing surface-level, goblin-like behaviors, what would it look like to consciously redesign the reward model of your own life? What if, instead of putting tape over your own check engine light, you built a system that measured the depth of your understanding, the quietness of your observation, and the strength of your internal plumbing, rather than just the objects you buy or the monuments you document?